We are on. Okay. Are there? Do you want to talk about Phaedrus at all? Do you feel pretty good about Phaedrus?
We're good.
Done with the Phaedrus?
We're good.
Thank the Lord. Okay. Well, let's talk about William S. Man. William S. Burroughs, just in case it hasn't been really obvious, is my favorite thing in life. You know, my boy's up there going for number one. My wife's up there all jockeying for number one, but William S. Burroughs. Few things are closer to my heart, make me happier in life than the fact that the existence of this man. Has anyone here ever read Burroughs?
Yeah.
Some of you. Okay. So let's approach this essay, because I don't know what else to call it. All right? What is this thing? You all read this? How's your responses? What is this? How do you even begin to make sense of this?
Systematic craziness?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's systematic. I'm not necessarily sure it's craziness. What is the first thing that struck you when you were reading this? After you were done reading this, what? How would you begin to make sense of this? What would be a way into this? In any way, it, you know, not necessarily even as a rhetorician. As a rhetorician, there's some obvious ways in. But just you reading this text, what do you make of this? Was this something you would normally read? What is this? What did you read? What do you call this? Your parents ask you, what did you read last night for your homework? And what do you tell them? Well, it's called Immortality by William Burroughs. Oh, really? Is it what, you know, philosophical inquiry into the possibilities of immortality? You know, the existential implications of immortality? What is this? Anyone proffer an answer? How would you even begin to make sense of this thing? Did it seem at all familiar to you? Anyone want to proffer something? Tell me something. How did you react to this? Okay, good. 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 So let's actually read the beginning, because it does begin scientifically. The colonel beams at the crowd, pomaded, manicured. He wears the satisfied expression of the one who has just sold the widow a fraudulent peach orchard. I wish science writing were like this. But there is an element of science, and that's good, right? And this will, you know, our reading of Nietzsche will help, should help you in reading this. How does it begin? What does it sound like when you first start reading it? Sounds like a short story, right? Setting a scene as a character, right? Is this a short story? Kinda, right? What's great about Burroughs and great about this essay, you know, I think I mentioned this once in class. There's an biography of his called Literary Outlaw. It's actually quite good, but, you know, he argues that, you know, you can't call me an outlaw, because that assumes I'm breaking a law. Let's assume I had a law to begin with. But I'm making up my own laws. I don't have a home with its own laws. Right? You don't begin from the place to say, well, he doesn't follow the conventions of this. Right? It's the most common way Burroughs has talked about. He doesn't do certain things. He doesn't follow narrative schemes. He doesn't stick to consistent characters. He doesn't even follow grammar. Right? He doesn't stick to a recognizable form. But that's all negative work, literally negative. It's saying what he's not doing. Right? And he says that's not a fair way to even begin thinking about what I'm up to here. Because I'm not responding to what's out there. I'm just writing. So what is this thing, right? What he forces upon us is this sort of reckoning of the absolutely different. Right? The thing that's sui generis, that's without genus, that's without category. Right, the particular thing. Right? Because if you try to, you say, begin scientifically, could you imagine quoting this in a scientific article? Would you invite him to come speak? Well, he's dead. But, you know, would you have invited him to come speak at the scientific conference? Could you picture them over at the labs, having William Burroughs come and speak? And they say he's a quack. But would he come speak at the literary conference? What can he do? Where can he go? Right? He's so particular that it's hard to put him in a category. It's basically impossible. It's the first thing I think he kind of throws at us, right? Is the impossibility of knowing him on terms other than his own. Right? It's impossible to know this text on terms other than its own. Right? All the negative work is only so interesting. Because you can say, well, this isn't a short story, yeah, but neither is my, you know, my hand. Right? Think of all the things that aren't short stories. The desk is not a short story. The chalkboard is not a short story. Vincent is not a short story. He's a long story. I'm not sure what that means. Right? But saying what something is not is not that productive. Right? Sometimes, you know, in the middle of a move within an essay, within an argument, you might say, well, you might think it's that, but it's not that. But then you do need to say what it is. You should always think about this when you're writing your papers. To just say that, you know, Plato's Phaedrus is not a traditional philosophical text. Don't tell me what it's not. First of all, you don't know what traditional philosophic texts look like. But regardless of that, don't tell me what something isn't. Tell me what it is. And that's what that's what's so, in a way, the rhetoric I'm trying to teach you is a rhetoric of affirmation, of positivity, of affirming what something is. Rather than all this negative work, which is very common in scholarship. It's very common, it's a very easy move to say what something is not. And a lot of people make their careers on that. Is that fair to say? Yeah, it's definitely a major premise of scholarship. Right? But it's very hard to say what something is. And everything we've looked at, you know, McLuhan doesn't just tear down. He actually says, no, here's a model. Here's how we go in the electronic age. Look at Nietzsche. He says, let's make more knowledge. Let's make it. Let's proliferate it. Look at Lauren Green. I mean, the Poetical Dictionary has to be one of the most generous books ever written. It just gives itself over, just more and more information. Just, right? He doesn't just argue against the traditional dictionary. He gives a different model and sort of fleshes it out. It's thorough in that sense. And so in many ways, what I'm giving you is a rhetoric of joy, rhetoric of affirmation, right? A rhetoric of positivity rather than a rhetoric of negativity. If you, this was actually the topic of my dissertation. If you look at how we think about rhetoric, how people think about rhetoric, it's always thought of negatively. Right? Rhetoric is something that comes after the fact. It's something you do, you twist language. But then language comes first, and rhetoric is what you do to twist it. Right? What happens when rhetoric comes first? What happens when the twist comes first? We've learned that there's no such thing as just a neutral word. That a word is already twisted. It's already an argument. There's no neutrality. Right? So in our worldview, rhetoric comes first, before language. There's not first language and then what you do to it. First comes rhetoric. Right? The basic unit of meaning, in a sense, for rhetoric is the argument. Not the word, not the sentence. Right? It's the grammar of the argument. It's the making of the world. Everything is inflected positively in this world. Right? And so what I've tried to show you when we read these texts is read it on its own terms, flesh it out, show me what's great about this text. Read it positively, read it affirmatively. And the reason I talk about this in some length here is that it's Burroughs' concern too. Not just performatively here, but explicitly, constitutively. The one thing he bashes in here, and he'll bash over and over in his writing, is the vampire. Right? And the vampire is the ultimate negative figure. It's the figure who just takes life for its own life. Rather than giving life, takes life, right? Sucks your blood because he doesn't have enough energy of his own. Right? Nietzsche will say that the overthrow of the Romans from Socrates and the Judeo-Christian slave revolt is a revolt basically of vampires, people who are resentful, who can't stand that, you know, the strong and the beautiful dominate. So they take over and they try to suck the good and the strong and the beautiful out of life. And they say, you know what? The meek shall inherit the earth. It's the ultimate sort of negative claim. The meek shall inherit the earth. Why the meek? Why not the strong and the beautiful and the cool and the magnanimous? Why the meek? Screw the meek. Right? But we have a culture that's premised on this. Right? The meek now run the world. The petty and the stupid and the weak, right? Rather than the magnanimous. Right? The vampires have taken over the world. What Burroughs doesn't give us here, and we'll get into this essay in some detail, is his positive term, what he calls the Johnson. The Johnson is the person who minds his own fucking business, but doesn't let you drown. Right? So he gives examples of Johnsons. He says he's like he's staying at some hotel. You know, and he's a junkie, and the bellhop tells him that the police are going to raid his room. So he has time to get out of there. He's like, that guy was a Johnson. He helped me out. He didn't have to help me out. He's like, I'm busted in jail, you know? And, you know, he shot his wife. He's in jail. Cop comes over and hands him a joint. He's like, the cop was a Johnson. He didn't have to do that. Didn't have to do that. It was a Johnson, the person who has some generosity, but fundamentally lets you live your own life. Okay? One thing I've tried to argue that rhetoric is this affirmation of a position that doesn't need to supersede your position, doesn't need to eat your position, doesn't need to work against your position. It doesn't need to be contrarian. Right? That there's the possibility of the proliferation of lots of different positions that may or may not collide, that can coexist. Right? And then on top of it, Burroughs gives us this kind of beautiful ethic of the Johnson. You know, the guy's drowning, you help him, right? But if, you know, two men are having sex, you let him go, right? Burroughs spent a lot of time in Mexico. He said, I can walk down the street holding hands with a boy, nobody cares. He goes, on the other hand, I carry a gun everywhere because that's what they do down there. So the vampire is you know, a lot of scholarship, a lot of critical thinking is vampiric, right? It eats at it. It sucks the life out of something. Imagine reading something, spending your life reading a book, reading an author, and saying what was wrong with that thing. What kind of person would do that? What kind of person would read a book over and over to say what's wrong with it? What a negative soul. What an energy to suck the vitality out of life. Right? If the book is not to your liking, don't read it. If you find the book offensive, don't read it. Right? Everything in this class is great. I would never give you something to read that wasn't great. Why would I? Why would we ever want to read something that sucks? So this is what he's positioning, right, in this essay. And so we are forced to reckon this thing in its particularity. It begins in this very strange way. The colonel beams at the crowd, pomaded, manicured. He wears the satisfied expression of one who's just sold the widow a fraudulent peach orchard. Folks, we're here to sell the only thing worth selling or buying, and that's immortality. Now, here is the simplest solution and well on the way. Just replace the worn parts and keep the old heap on the road indefinitely. First of all, you can think about voice here. Voices are insane here. Who's speaking ever in this essay? How does this essay even deploy its arguments? What vehicles does it use? Look at the next, right? Paragraph. As transplant techniques are perfected and refined, the age-old dream of mortality is now within the grasp of mankind. But who is to decide out of a million applicants for the same heart? That's a very reasonable question, right? That's a reasonable premise to begin building an argument and a discussion, right? This would be for a debate club, right, guy? This is the kind of question you'd ask. Right? Who should decide this kind of thing? It's quite reasonable, right? He's arguing reasonably. But how does that sentence relate to what just preceded it? It's very strange, right? Burroughs deploys in an argument less words per se and logic than scenes, possibilities, images, right? He deploys gestures. He sees everything always as gestural. So he'll never just give you a straight, clear, logical argument. Although he does deploy logic. I mean, the end of this essay, and we'll track his logic at the end of this, is so exquisite and hilarious at the same time. But he doesn't, I would argue, doesn't argue with words. Right? That for him, this basic unit is an image. Gives you this image, the colonel beaming at the crowd, right? He wears the satisfied expression of the one who just sold the widow a fraudulent peach orchard. Right? He gives you a whole inhabited being. Right? Nothing's not inhabited for him. Right? And so he is making an argument about immortality. Right? There is a whiff of science in here. He's making claims about society, about science, about how the two interrelate, about the possibilities of immortality, about what it means. He's talking about life, its freaking self. And he deploys like fragments of life, fragments of possible life, these sort of hyper-caricaturized, demented scenes, rather than strictly logic or even words. I'd argue that he doesn't even use words. He'll claim that words are a virus from outer space, that words occupy us. You got to break the word to form the image. The image is more free. The image can go forwards and backwards. The image has a kind of multiplicity all at once, right, that the word doesn't have. The word he sees as a kind of death. The image is a kind of life. So should we keep reading? Okay. There simply aren't enough parts to go around. Big executives use a heart a month just as regular as clockwork. Warlords paying off their soldiers in livers and kidneys and genitals depopulate whole areas. Vast hospital cities cover the land from the air-conditioned hospital palaces of the rich, radiating out to field hospitals and open-air operating booths. The poor are rising in huge mobs. They are attacking government warehouses where the precious parts are stored. Everyone who can afford it has dogs and guards to protect himself from roving bands of part hunters like the dreaded wild doctors who operate on each other after the battle, cutting the warm, quivering parts from the dead and dying. Cut-and-grab men dart out of doorways and hack out a kidney with a few expert strokes of the 4-inch scalpels. People have lost all shame. Here's a man who sold his daughter's last kidney to buy himself a new groin. Appears on TV to appeal for funds to buy little Sally an artificial kidney and give her this last Christmas. On his arm is a curvaceous blonde, known apparently as Bubbles. She calls him Long John. Now, isn't that cute? What's going on? I hope you laughed when you read this. This has to be one of the funniest things I've ever written. What's going on here? What did he just do? How does it just rhetorically, how does this perform? At its most simple, what's happening here? Yeah, it's absolutely. I mean, he gives a premise. He says, well, okay. Let's say, you can map it out logically, too. Say, immortality is possible if we just keep transplanting parts. But, of course, that's vampiric. Where do the parts come from? And so then he just shows you. He just fleshes out this whole scene. He just follows the scenario all the way. Right? To show if this is how you want to go, this is the result. These are the effects. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and the greed in the market, yeah. Right? But because what does he say? He has a fundamental argument in here about quantity. Anything that's quantitative finally runs out, right? Anything that's quantitative that can be reduced down to numbers or quantity at some point will become vampiric, right? It will exhaust itself, right? And then we'll have to, and so it will constantly have to feed itself from elsewhere. Right?
And he fleshes out the positive. Like, he seems very, negative, but yeah. Then all of a sudden he says, isn't that cute?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, the whole ambivalent thing, right? The guy who, takes, he sold his daughter's last kidney to buy himself a new groin, goes to TV to buy her a kidney, right? It's such a hilarious exchange, right? You see the network of exchange, right? The network of greed, the network of vampirism. Right, it is capitalism. It's this whole network of exchange between all these parts that all need each other, and it's he doesn't give up on his daughter. Yeah,
and he creates a whole world. He throws so much information at you in that one paragraph that you just get really immersed in the idea of a mortal world or a place where just dangerous on the street.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's not that far off, right? I mean, when you see things like, vast hospital cities cover the land from the air-conditioned hospital palaces of the rich. Such a great, beautiful image. It's not that far off, right?
And also makes you think of, real-life donor systems.
Yeah.
The concept that only the rich can really afford.
Absolutely. Absolutely, right? But so here he is arguing, right? But notice how this is fiction. It's fiction. That's an argument, rather explicitly, right? If you ever wondered if, how can you consider fiction an argument? Well, the fact is it always is. Here he is. Can you separate the fiction in this from the argument in this? Is this literature or is this polemics? Burroughs will erase the line that separates the two from each other. Right? He exists in a world. He writes from a world that Nietzsche would call the mythic. Right? He's already there. Right? So he's not tearing down things. He already exists in this place of pure positivity. He just writes as if that were the case. He doesn't feel the need to say, well, this essay might be a little untraditional. I'm going to use some fiction here. He just scrambles the categories, right, just left and right without even thinking twice about it. This is what he does. This is what writing is to him. You're always already cutting shit up, you cut shit up. Poop up. Right? A flourishing black market in parts grows up in the gutted cities, devastated by part riots and terrible slums. Scenes from Bugle and Bosch are reenacted, misshapen masses of rotten scar tissue crawling with maggots, supported on crutches and canes and wheelchairs and carts. Brutal as butchers, practitioners operate without anesthetic in open-air booths surrounded by their bloody knives and saws. The poor wait in part lines for diseased genitals, a cancerous lung, a cirrhotic liver. They crawl toward the operating booths, holding forth nameless things in bottles that they think are usable parts. Shameless swindlers who buy up operating garbage and job lots prey on the unwary. That is an unbelievable paragraph, man. That is an unbelievable paragraph. Right? He's the greatest writer of the 20th century.
Pretty close representation of the state of the health care, especially in San Francisco.
Yeah.
These days, you know, for almost equal. It's a pretty accurate description.
I love the crawl toward the operating booths holding forth nameless things in bottles. That pretty much seems about right. Pretty much, even not for the homeless, right? For the middle class. Right? Sort of go, I was like, this came out of me, doc. What do you think? Pretty much every visit I ever make to the doctor. Right? And here's Mr. Richparts. He's 300 years old. He's still subject to accidental death, and the mere thought of it throws him into paroxysms of idiot terror. For days, he cowers in his bunker 200 feet down in solid rock, food for 50 years. A trip from one city to another requires months of shifting and checking computerized plans and alternate routes to avoid the possibility of an accident. His idiotic cowardice knows no bounds. There he sits, looking like a Chimu vase with a thick layer of smooth purple scar tissue. Encased in this armor, his movements are slow and hydraulic. It takes him 10 minutes to sit down. The layer gets thicker and thicker, right down to the bone. The doctors have to operate with power tools. So we leave Mr. Richparts and the picturesque parts people, their monument, a mountain of scar tissue. That's unreal, man. I mean, these images are so palpable. He deploys, again, these visceral, again, it's not really words, right? He's like deploying a whole visceral life. Do you understand what I'm saying, right? Rather than ever thinking argument might be this thing that is logical or, you know, dignified, he's always already putting into play this whole kind of these elaborated, palpable scenes, right, that are so thorough, so... I mean, all the way down to his bone, you know what his bones look like, his age, how he gets from point A to point B. Now, this is not a casual, well, people might grow quite old and become afraid of accidents. Right? Instead, he deploys, he operates in a fundamentally different language, I think, than we operate in. Right? In a fundamentally different place, right? Where the world is made up of this. The world is made up of gestures, of scenes, of images. Not of logics and words, although those are at play within the images. Keep going, because this is a good part. Mr. L. Ron Hubbard said, "The rightest thing a man could be would be to live infinitely wrong." I wrote wrong for long, and the slip is significant. For the means by which immortality is realized in science fiction, which will soon be science fact, are indeed infinitely wrong. The wrongest wrong a man can be, vampiric or worse. This is so hilariously beautiful, this little paragraph. He quotes L. Ron Hubbard, misquotes him, and says, that's his argument now. Right? It's a little like Socrates in that passage with Phaedrus, right? The mistake becomes productive, pure positivity. Right? I love that, right? I wrote wrong for long, and a slip is significant. And that's going to be his argument. The rightest thing a man could be would be to live infinitely wrong. And then this beautiful moment for which, by means which immortality is realized in science fiction, which will soon be science fact. Right? That's the place beyond truth and lies. Right? We don't separate this thing. You'll notice throughout the course of this when he quotes texts, he quotes them as if they're, just like we would quote something as a basis of knowledge, but it's such a weird send-up, such a weird metabolization of academic, scholarly, or scientific writing, right? Because he quotes science fiction as if it's fact, right? You never even know what plane it's operating in, right? He doesn't allow you that distinction between fact and fiction, He doesn't allow you the distinction, I think, between word and image. He's already operating in this other place, right? This place beyond truth and lies. Does that make some sense? Right? I don't know if it makes any sense. All right, you guys are freakishly quiet. This essay makes you quiet. Why does it make you so quiet? Is it just my? It's very quiet in here, isn't it? All right, let's keep going. right. Improved transplant techniques open the question as to whether the ego itself could be translated from one body to another, transplanted from one body to another, and the further question as to exactly where this entity resides. Again, it's a very reasonable question. It's a philosophical question. It's a scientific question. He blurs so many categories in the casual proffering of this question. Where is this ego? Where does it reside? And the further question, here's Mr. Hart, a trillionaire dedicated to his personal immortality. I love the introduction of that. Here's Mr. Hart. And he just gives them to you. Like he gives you an argument or a fact. He gives you a scene. He gives you this whole elaborated possibility of life. Right. So here's Mr. Hart, trillionaire dedicated to his personal immortality. Where is this thing called Mr. Hart? Precisely where in the human nervous system does this ugly, death-sucking, death-dealing, death-fearing thing reside? Science can give a tentative answer. The ego seems to be located in the midbrain at the top of the head. Well, he thinks, couldn't we just scoop it out of a healthy youth, throw it in the garbage where it belongs, and slide in me? So he starts looking for a brain surgeon, a scrambled egg man, and he wants the best. When it comes to a short-order job, old Doc Zaitis tops. He can switch eggs in an alley. This is, again, so great, right? So he follows a scientific claim, right? If he can follow, where's the self exist? Well, maybe up here. He's like, okay, let's follow from a presumed fact to what happens if we take that knowledge seriously. If science really proffers this answer, right, that the self, the ego, the main core of yourself exists somewhere in your head, well then, let's see what happens. Let's scoop it out. Right? He follows the implications of knowledge. Right? He's like, what's at stake here? What's at stake in a fact, what's at stake in a piece of knowledge is a life that's lived. Right? There is no such thing as knowledge that's not lived through. Right? That is, in a way, the basic premise of this class, or one of the basic premises of this class. There's no knowledge for knowledge's sake. Rhetoric wouldn't know what that means. Rhetoric always looks at the effects. Everything's an argument. All knowledge is an argument. It has effects. What are the effects? So here he takes, okay, science says this. Well, here's Mr. Hart. Here's what happens. Right? So Mr. Hart embodies the competitive, acquisitive, success-minded spirit that formulated American capitalism. The logical extension of his ugly spirit is criminal. Success is its own justification. He who succeeds deserves to succeed. He is right. Okay. Again, this is what Burroughs is constantly coming down on. The vampiric and the person then who thinks he's right. And the person who thinks he's justified in exerting his will and taking from the world. The person who feels entitled to devour the world for his own purposes. Okay. Which is really anyone who thinks that they know better, that they're right. I know better, so I'm going to go bomb your country. I know it's right. I'm going to go, you know, put you in jail. I know, so I can take things from you. Right. The operation is a success. The doctors have discreetly withdrawn. When a man wakes up in a beautiful new bod, he can flip out. It wouldn't pay to be a witness. It is so good, man. He just follows it all the way through down to the doctors, you know. Wouldn't pay to be a witness. Mr. Hart stands up and stretches luxuriously in his new body. He runs his hands over the lean young muscle where his pot belly used to be. All that remains of the donor is a blob of gray matter in a dish. Mr. Hart puts his hands on his hips and leans over the blob. And how wrong can you be? Dead. He spits on it, and he spits ugly. Okay. But that's, you see, for Burroughs, he's constantly like, okay, just because we've gotten rid of a certainty and a truth doesn't mean we've gotten rid of the ability to make ethical judgments. This is ugly spirit. You're a disgusting vampire. He actually passes relentless judgment. Right? You'll see it in Nietzsche too. Nietzsche, who says God's dead and celebrates, you know, the sort of post-truth and lies, passes relentless judgment on the world. You're resentful. You're weak. I'm not. right? Doesn't mean just because we sacrifice or we move past a notion of certainty doesn't mean we give up judgment. We now make judgments from within the qualitative world, right? From the world that we live in and inhabit. The ugly spirit, man. This is a disgusting being. Does that make some sense? Right? He still leaves himself the possibility of assessment. And it's one of the main arguments I've been trying to make, that we don't, it's not relativity, everything's groovy. It's everything's relative, things are really complicated. It's very different. Yeah, yeah. That was very nice. That's a good catch. Very nice. Right. The final convulsions of a spirit, the final convulsions of a universe based on quantitative factors like money, junk, and time would seem to be at hand. Right? The time approaches when no amount of money will buy anything and time itself will run out. Right? You got it. You know, we live right now in a very strange time, right? Over the last few years, there's been this unbelievable rise in consumption, right? There's been this sort of pouring in of wealth in this country, right? And you have to notice the ubiquity of buying shit, right? There's stuff everywhere to buy. It's unbelievable. I got to raise my kid walking down the street. He wants to buy stuff all the time, everywhere, right? Because there's stuff everywhere. You can't walk down the street without something being sold to you, right? It's unbelievable. I take him to the zoo, and the zoo now is like sponsored by Fisher-Price. It's unbelievable. And he's like, I want that unbelievably disgusting, stupid plastic thing that costs $40. I'm like, no. I got to spend half my time explaining to him why I'm not going to buy him more crap. Okay? So there's this constant will. And how would it ever exhaust itself? Right? That's his point. That once you've gone to the quantitative, once you've gone to say, yeah, my life is premised on getting stuff, how could you ever stop it? What would be the point? Is necessarily infinite.
Yeah. I think one thing to keep in mind is he's saying the spirit that formulates capitalism is ultimately criminal. Uh-huh. And I think that, I mean, I know that Burroughs is, he's kind of poo-pooing Freud and Marx, but he's also giving us an argument that's very close to what Max Weber gives, which basically saying that the origin of the spirit is Benjamin Franklin. Uh-huh. The idea is Franklin was the first person to say that time is money.
Right.
So the argument that the result of that is criminal, I think, is something that's
an indictment of, you mean a secret indictment of fundamentally the American way of going?
Yeah.
I mean, he'll say in other essays many, many times that the Western white man is a virus, is a mutation gone terribly awry. Right? Just, you know, eating through the world, leaving nothing. He really sees it as a mutation. So one thing also to realize about Burroughs, in this post kind of beyond truth and lie space, in this space that doesn't make clear distinctions between fact and fiction, he also operates in this kind of post-human perspective, right, where he really looks at the human as an organism, right, on this planet and watches how it interacts, how it goes. Right? So some of his very frank portrayals of humanity would be that different than a nature show, right? Watching some kind of animal. Yes, you know, the so-called lizard eats the head off its spouse and then shits it out and eats it again. Or, you know, you'd be like, oh, interesting. But Burroughs does that to the human. Right? So he's in a sort of post-human perspective. He's sort of looking down at the human species as this kind of organism amongst organisms. And he'll say, you know, the Western white man is an aberration. A mutation gone terribly awry, a sick virus on the planet. The time approaches when no amount of money will buy anything and time itself will run out. And here he does this great, he starts quoting his sources. In The Methuselah Enzyme by Fred Mustard Stewart. You have no idea. I have no idea whether he made this up or not. Right? And it's such a great moment. You have no idea. And it doesn't matter. Is it real, if it's real or not? Right? It's such a beautiful moment, right? By Fred Mustard Stewart. Dr. Mencius, a Swiss scientist, has found the youth enzyme, which he calls Mentas. It turns out tithy for tithinus, or so for sovkipa, would have been more apt. This is a recurring thing in Burroughs, the soap keeper. Save your ass, every man for himself. Right? That's the Johnson. It's every man for himself, but the person who still stands back and helps you out a little bit without getting all moral on you, that's the Johnson. Every man for himself. But you know what, Bill? The cops are going to raid your hotel room. I'd skadoodle. Right? It's such a beautiful moment, right? Of that bell man, that bell boy. Bellhop? What's it called? Bellhop? Right? Just to give him that tip. Every man for himself. But you know what? It's possible to still lend a hand now and again without being a moral, self-righteous creep. Right? He really gives us an ethics of the ethics of the Johnson. Young kids secrete this elixir, and senior citizens need it special. Mentas is gradually phased out of the body from about the age of 25 to 60. The key word is extraction. Mentas is a long way from the synthesis of Mentas, but to use an untested substance extracted without their knowledge or consent from young people and old people. He feels a distinct twinge in his medical ethics. The Mentas, he says grimly, must not be lost to humanity. Mentas is regarded as a brilliant lunatic by his medical colleagues. Where can we turn for funds? He takes on four rich clients who will bring the young donors. The madness of this paragraph, man, is so fantastic, right? It begins with this claim about the quantitative universe. It's almost a logical philosophical argument about the nature of desire for the quantity. Anything that's fundamentally quantitative, you'll always want more of, right? That's the nature of it. It doesn't have a limit, right? Numbers go on infinitely. So if you're interested in numbers, you can always want the next one, right? It says money, junk, here's heroin. It's the same thing. You're going to always want the next hit. You're always going to want some more. Right? He says that's the evil of heroin. Right? He's a junkie. He also talks about the good things of heroin. Right? He says you'll live forever. It slows down your metabolism. And he did live quite long. Right? But look at this paragraph. Right? Then he quotes his source. Right? In the Methuselah enzyme by Fred Stewart. You know, Fred Mustard Stewart. It seems quite reasonable. Next thing you know, that everything's going nuts. Right, he has this beautiful will just to madness, right? He, at every turn, he wants to amplify the nuttiness. Right? What a generous spirit he is. What a generous spirit. Yeah, Vincent.
It's interesting that he keeps on giving these descriptions of the vampiric as being that which is so connected to itself that it tries to perpetuate itself indefinitely, and it always leads to a sort of living death, like the monument of scar tissue.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the same time, I think we can probably relate this to his own quotation, the way that he, you know, quotes Dr. Mencius.
Right, right, right.
And then, you know, even the beginning of the of immortality begins with that James Dean quote,
right,
which is actually it's you know, attributed to James Dean by David Bolton.
Right, right, right.
So there's this constant, like, he seems to be working against the sort of self-enclosure that the sort of will to live forever in that manner would work.
That's nice. That's nice. That was sharp. That's good. Well, that's good. We'll come back to that, right? To these shapes and to what's that? What are the stakes of immortality for him, and what are the conditions? He really is. What's at stake here is really a kind of ethics. It's really this is an essay on ethics, right? The ethics of human beings, the ethics of the relationship between fiction and fact, the relationship between genres, the relationship between reader and text. He must have blacked out in the immersion tank, Bill reflects. Later, he found a tiny sticking plaster up near the hairline. Again, who's speaking here? The proliferation of voices that he'll deploy, right? There are all kinds of voices constantly speaking in his text. Talk about the death of the author. He loves the death of the author. I mean, he's like, yeah, for him, it's a liberation. He gets to deploy all these voices in all these different ways all the time. And he says over and over throughout his career, I'm just a transcriber. If things come to me, I just write them down. I'm not the author. That's why he spent a large part of his writing cutting things up, folding them together. Because he's just a DJ here. Right? So look at the play of voices in here. It's insane. Right? It's great. Oh, I should bring in him reading. That's what I'll do maybe for Tuesday. Him reading is unbelievable. Right? Because he has like, think how many voices there are. What would it mean to read this? right? I mean, I'm just reading it straight, but there's 10,000 voices going through here, right? There are constantly new voices coming in. How do you read this? And it's hilarious when you hear him read, because he's constantly slightly inflecting. He's got this kind of beautiful voice, beautiful deadpan. Can you picture his voice at all? Is he a character who means anything to you guys? William Burroughs? I guess not. So iconic to me, right? He's got this kind of, I want to say famous voice, but if you don't know it, then I guess it's not that famous. But he constantly kind of inflects it in this kind of vaudeville, right? Vaudeville is one of his key figures. You can picture this essay as a kind of vaudeville routine, right? There's the nutty, you know, Eggman doing the surgery in the back room, right? Here's the guy cutting off his, you know, taking his daughter's kidney to give himself a long schlong, right? It's a whole series of routines, kind of like the Muppet Show. It's a big vaudeville routine. Does that make sense? Do you know what the Muppet Show is? Right, the variety show. Like, it's such a great notion, the variety show, the show that has multiple shows. You know, that's, I love that kind of thing.
Yeah. It's especially interesting that in that quotation that's given, where you don't know who's speaking, it says Bill reflects. And of course, he's Bill himself.
Absolutely.
But you don't know if he's this Bill or. You
know, absolutely,
he's
right.
Bill and not this Bill.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's perfect. It's so good, right? Because what. It's so complicated right there. You have no idea who's speaking right there. Zero. And then it's Bill all of a sudden. But it's Bill in quotes. And he's talking about himself, Bill reflects. What voice is it that says Bill reflects? Right? There's the voice that thinks something. There's the voice that says Bill reflects. Right? There's so many voices right there embedded in each other. Do you see that? Right? And it's what's great about Burroughs, that he is this kind of voice of so many voices. That's what he's always deploying. That's what he deploys, maybe. One way to think about it is he deploys voices. Right? He deploys routines, he calls them, right? The vaudeville routine, the shtick.
And there's the voice of Bill Burroughs.
Right. Himself. Right. Which you can hear throughout the whole thing. The kids don't know that they're giving their mentass to the elderly sponsor, and here's one old creep, and I love his constant refrain of here. Right? Here. Here's Mr. Hart. Here's the old creep. He's constantly making it, like offering it up. Right? It's both an insistence on here it is right now, but also an offering up as argumentation. And what he offers up as argumentation is life, this piece of life, this insane piece of possible existence that is an existence. Right? Here it is. Here's this. Right? So here's one old creep who brings his own adolescent son to the clinic and sucks all the youth and goodness out of him. So the oldsters are getting younger, and the kids, phew dear, those interesting freckles, what are they? They're liver spots. The doctor has to admit he has made a real dummheit all around. The old farts don't produce any mentass of their own. All they have is what the doctor gives them. And now an emergency, a shocking emergency, quite unlooked for, has arisen. The doctor feels ashen-faced from his microscope. This is, again, a beautiful moment, right? He just follows a knowledge claim down its path. If we can follow, if we can place the self here in the top of the head, well then, if you want immortality, we're going to start scooping out each other's brains. And it ends in this horrible vampiric cycle. Okay, so now we discovered this fluid, this enzyme. Okay, let's start taking it from the youth. But then all of a sudden, an emergency, never thought about it. If I take it out of the kids, there's none left. So now the kids are getting old. And now the kids got to go get theirs. And it's these cycles of vampirism. Right, that he's constantly kind of in horror over, right? These systems that are based in these facts that then metabolize themselves, kill themselves. So he shows that all these paths to immortality are in fact these paths, you know, Vincent called it a living death, but a kind of, certainly an eradication of life. Does that make sense? Right, so all of a sudden we have this emergency, a shocking emergency, quite unlooked for. The doctor feels ashen-faced, reels ashen-faced. He knows that if the injections of mentass are cut off, the aging process will recommence at a vastly accelerated rate. The stricken senior citizen would age before one's eyes. While still alive and aware of what was happening, he quite literally disintegrated, he tells him flatly. The only relief you could possibly have would be to go insane. Which is, again, come on. That's an unbelievable sentence. The only relief you could possibly have would be to go insane. Right? Talk about the scrambling categories. The terms of what's at stake here are so different, right? So exquisitely different. the relief will be insanity, right? So the madness of his own text becomes a kind of relief from it. And the good doctor has some new kids who are already comparing liver spots. By cutting off part of your pineal gland, we seem to have halted your production of mentas. And the result is, in plain English, that you're aging 100 times as fast as normal, the doctor admits lamely. Boom, the acute shortage of mentas. The key word is extraction. The aging kids, now as lost to shame as their elders, in fact, rapidly becoming elders, that is to say, coarse, ugly, and as shameless as they are disgusting, go out to recruit kids for mentas, paid in mentas, of course, and each recruit must in turn recruit more donors. Think how that could build up in 5 years, bearing in mind the extremely short productive period of the donors. So great, right? These vicious cycles. Right? These vampiric cycles of culture is what he's arguing against, right? And he keeps showing us how they operate, right? Showing that he's revealing to us the ugliness of the vampire, which seems to be at the heart of contemporary capitalism. Does that make sense? Y'all with me here?
Yeah.
All right. Augustus is. This is like surfing the web. Right? And I love this. You know, it's this great moment here. Puts me in mind of the old fur farm swindle. Come on, that's a hilarious line. Right? Because, again, it's this like call, like we should all know what he's talking about, right? Puts me in mind of that old fur farm swindle. You invest $500 and you buy a pair of mink. The farm is usually in Canada, which has always been a center for mail fraud. The farm will take care of your mink, who will breed every 6 months, producing a litter of eight or more mink, who in turn will pair and breed at the age of 6 months. Right? So you see the possibility of this great cycle of productivity. Right? You buy this thing, it'll make more and more and more and more and more. That's the swindle, right? It's the same as the swindle for immortality. Here's the way to get there. This is a way to get your immortality. We'll make more and more and more. But it turns out it's this vicious cycle. It gives you less and less and less and less. Get a paper and pencil, and that's not all. Some of the mink will be mutants, green and blue and albino and seashell pink, or maybe you hit the jackpot with rainbow mink, $2,000 a pelt. As you luxuriate in rack after rack of ankle-length mint, coats of letter etched in black arise from the farm. Regret to inform you, your two minks died of distemper. Right, the ravening mentas addicts need more and more and more. Any purely quantitative factor is devalued in time with junk, money, mentas. I love this. It's a great moment. Thanks for coming. Right? Notice also the grammar, right? Commas fall away here. Right? Right? He doesn't feel the need to distinguish. She made about as long as Felix made it. That's pretty good, an hour. She'll never be the same, of course. She's gonna, like, nightmares. What is that Jew saying? That junk, money, mentas, right? It becomes this kind of triumvirate, right? Commas fall away, grammar gives way in his universe, right? In the madness of his universe. So the purely quantitative factor is devalued in time, right? It takes more and more to buy less and less. Does that make sense? Right? You see, with gasoline, right? I need gas, I got to keep driving my car, I need a bigger car, right? It's insane, right? You see it happening right in front of us at a very alarming clip these days. Doesn't that seem right? Man, I mean, I've seen it happen in San Francisco. I moved to San Francisco in 1991. This was like a slacker town. Right? It was the rise. I was Gen X, man. That movie had just come out, Slacker. You ever see this film? Richard Linklater. Right, it's a great film. Called Slackers, and it was, you know, everyone just sort of roaming around Austin, Texas. And I passed through Austin on my way here, into Georgia, to Austin, up to here, and it was cheap. Just bummed on people's couches. I worked 3 days a week at a bookstore. Everything was easy. Living was easy in San Francisco. Right? I was a grad student. I lived alone in my own apartment in San Francisco, living on what you guys make. Salaries haven't changed that much. Right? It was unbelievable. Right? That was the life. Now I'm scrambling. I got to make so much freaking money, well into six figures, to break even in the city. Right? The restaurants, the turnover of restaurants in my neighborhood is staggering. Staggering. Right? What's happened to the Mission since I moved there? Staggering, right? I can't afford anything in that neighborhood anymore, right? And it's just more and more. So now I got to go work more, so I can do the same things, right? So I'm busting my ass to make more and more shit. I'm getting driven harder and harder, right? By idiots out there who demand this pace, right? Because the quantitative, you need to get more and more and more, just to get the same stuff, just to get the same stuff, right? Just to fill your car up with gas, just to get your lunch. Right? The price of food is staggering these days. Especially if you want it not infected with, you know, the diseases they put in food. Right? So you actually bought an organic apple recently? It's like $2 for an apple. It's insane. So that's his argument here. Right? Right? The junk money mentas takes more and more to buy less and less. Maybe Mr. Hart has a warehouse of mentas to obtain, which is depopulated a continent. It will run out in time. Long before it runs out, he'll reach the point where no amount of mentas he can inject into his aging carcass will halt the aging process. It's the same thing with heroin, right? You build up a certain tolerance, you need more. You build up a certain tolerance, you need more. You build up a certain tolerance, you need more. There's always more that buys less and less and less. The first time you shoot it, you're high as a kite, you feel great. And it's called chasing the dragon. You'll never get it back. So you keep going. Give me more just to get less and less on every return. Right? Anything that's based on quantity, according to Burroughs, collapses. So what he gives us is a world premised not on quantity, but on quality. Right? And it's what I've tried to argue in a way all along. Right? That classical rhetorical logic, argumentative logic, is really premised on the same premise as numbers. Right? It's mathematical. Right? It seeks to be quantitative. Right? That's what logic is. Well, it's just logically sound. Here's my proposition. I can follow from my axioms, and argument becomes quantitative. Right? But I've tried to shift this into a qualitative phase, right? Where you actually begin to make sense of the world with quality. And what's mysterious about quality is that it's never certain. It can't be fixed. Quantities can be fixed. It's either number three or not number three. When you take a math class, right or wrong answers are pretty clear, right? Does that make sense? Right, this is the right answer. The numbers, it's either that number or not. Now, there might be different ways of going about it when you get more and more complicated mathematics. The answer at some point can be measured. How do you measure here? How do you write papers? How do we measure you? What's our criteria? It's there and not there. It's absolutely sure and it's never certain. Right? And it's this very strange place that rhetoric operates in. Precisely when certainty has gone away, when the certainty of quantity has vanished. And now we live in a world that is defined qualitatively. Right? And what I've tried to suggest to you, as Burroughs performs here, that when we operate in a qualitative universe, we still do have the ability to make sense. There are limits between things. Things have, we can distinguish. We can pass certain kinds of judgment. We can assess. That just because we get rid of certainty, and the certainty implicit in quantity, and the quantity implicit in certainty, doesn't mean we eliminate all distinctions between things, any ability to judge things. You know, we're still absolutely comfortable grading you. No problem giving you guys grades. I can assess your writing. I can say, yeah, that's A writing, that's not A writing. That's like a B+. We can make those very fine assessments. Based on what? Based on something, but it's not fixed, it's not certain, it's not a grid. But we have no problem making it, and for the most part, have no problem accepting it. Right? What is that strange space? What is that strange place in which we judge your papers, in which you're graded? Right? It's kind of a beautiful space. Right? I mean, I'm not necessarily interested in the grading thing per se, but grading as a form of a kind of assessment of the qualitative is in fact a form of assessment. It hasn't disappeared. Implicit within this A to F scale is the fact that we do have some kind of criterion. Whether I can tell you exactly what it is, you know, got to be grammatical. You got to make a good argument. You got to be interesting. It has to be provocative. You got to move from point A to point B in a way that I can follow. Yeah, okay. But whether it works or not, it's just, you know it when you see it. Right? But you do know it when you see it. Right? And that's the peculiar moment. So Burroughs is shifting us, showing us what's at stake. If you think about immortality, which presumably is the ultimate more, the ultimate call to quantity. Does that make sense? Immortality is the fundamental call to quantity. I need more of this. I want this infinitely. And he's shown that a quantitative answer to this infinite more will always, you'll always be getting less and less. Right? You want this enzyme, at some point it's going to exhaust itself. So by the end of this essay, he's going to shift the argument and say the way to immortality is in fact qualitative. All right, so we'll get there. Mentas is a parable of vampirism gone berserk. But all vampiric bluefins for immortality are wrong, not only from the ethical standpoint. They are ultimately unworkable. This is his beautiful argument, right? Because his point here is not just, right, that these images he gives us are ethically grotesque, right? The man who takes his daughter's kidney to buy himself a bigger penis, right? That's not only just ethically grotesque. He argues that it's fundamentally unworkable. It's not the answer. You, in fact, won't get immortality that way. Right? So he's, in fact, making a practical claim about these things. Yeah, and he's yeah, I don't know. I don't know anything about Karl Marx.
It sounds fairly Marxist in a lot of ways.
I don't know anything what that means. I never read Marx. No. I read the Communist Manifesto in 11th grade, and I never read any Marx again.
Marx describes commodity production as a sort of transformation of the living material of the laborer's body into pure exchangeable quantity. Which, in the way that he puts it, is in terms of nerves and cells and flesh.
Is that right?
Yeah. In Capital.
Really? My family heirloom was a copy of Das Kapital.
Yeah?
Yeah, from my grandmother. She left that to me. I come from old communists. But it's in German, so yeah, keep going. Yeah.
Well, so there's this sort of transformation of life into pure quantity in that movement, which seems to be similar to what
Yeah. I didn't know Marx pulled that out, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's true. Although, but in a way, it's, you know, like commodity production is already the exchange of body parts.
Huh. I like that, right? Do you understand Vincent quoting Marx up here? That when you buy shit, right, labor at some point has put itself into there. And somebody was telling me that when you go to China now, it's so depressing because everywhere you look, people are making stupid little things. Everywhere you look, there's people, they're just like making little plastic gadgets. Right, everywhere, the streets are lined with them. Right, and that it's quite depressing because you're actually then you go and buy this thing, and so you in a way have bought a piece of that person. Right, and that's the terms of labor. Right, does that make sense? That's why I always dug teaching in some sense, right? Because it's I feel like I'm in control of the means of production. It's the only job that's not humiliating. Okay. So they're ultimately unworkable. In Space Vampires, Colin Wilson speaks of benign vampires. Such a great moment, man. He quotes anything, right? Every text to him is fact. Is he doesn't distinguish between things. Everything, you either learn something from it or you don't. All the world to him is knowledge, right? That's what I've been trying to tell you, that like that rather than saying there's no such thing as knowledge, what we've in fact said is everything is knowledge. Right, that all art is a kind of knowledge. Right, it assembles the world in a certain way. It makes claims. Right, so here he quotes Colin Wilson's Space Vampires, and this is almost like a classical argument where he proffers the possibility that his own argument isn't right. Well, is there the possibility of a workable vampiric model? Well, let's look at Colin Wilson's book. Right, in Space Vampires, Colin Wilson speaks of benign vampires. Take a little, leave a little. But they always take more than they leave by the basic nature of the vampiric process of inconspicuous but inexorable consumption. The vampire converts quality, live blood, vitality, youth, talent, into quantity, food, and time for himself. He perpetuates the most basic betrayal of the spirit, reducing all human dreams to his shit. And that's the wrongest wrong a man can be. Now, he's not fucking around here, Burroughs, man. Right? This is a strong sentence, right? And personal immortality in a physical body is impossible, since a physical body exists in time, and time is that which ends. When someone says he wants to live forever, he forgets that forever is a time word. All three-dimensional immortality projects are, to say the least, ill-advised, since they immerse the aspirant always deeper into time. The tiresome concept of personal immortality is predicated on the illusion of some unchangeable, precious essence, that is, the greedy old me forever. The Buddhists say there is no me, no unchanging ego. Right? This is a beautiful, nasty move, man. This is just like beautiful argumentation. Okay. It's at once logical and absolutely insane. It's like, if you want to think about immortality with your body, you will necessarily fail. The body cannot persist. It is a temporal being. Time runs out. Right? Time is a quantity, and therefore, and you might argue that that's not quite right, but time is a quantity, and the more you immerse yourself in time, the more you immerse yourself in the body, you will fail. He has a great, great book, his best novel called The Western Lands. Did you read that? Oh, yeah. The Western Lands is unbelievable. It's his masterpiece. It's all about getting to the Western Lands, the land of the dead, that the Egyptians had. And he begins with a fundamental critique of the Egyptian model. He's like, the Egyptians, you had to be mummified, right? And your mummy had to stay uncontaminated in order to get to the afterlife. Right? And so he has this whole elaborate shtick, right, where he talks about, you know, the guy who's doing the mummification is paid off by the guy's enemies to, you know, leave a hole in the fabric so the body rots out and can't get to the Western lands. To show you that the body will not get you there. Right? It's such a hilarious, beautiful moment. You want the blueprint to immortality? And he actually looks to the Egyptians, he's like, did they know? Did they have the way? Nope, because he argues they went on a faulty premise. The point being, for him, history, science, literature, it's all part of how you go. He doesn't make any distinctions. It's all stuff to be taken and deployed in your life. What's at stake in everything he learns, reads, discovers, thinks, is a life that's led. Does that make sense? Why I'm saying that? So now it starts to get really freaking good. What we think of as our ego is a defensive reaction, just as the symptoms of an illness, fever, swelling, sweating, are the body's reaction to an invading organism. Again, he puts the human on the level of an organism. Right? And he makes an argument here akin to Nietzsche's. Right? That the will to say, I'm me, right? Or I know the truth, is born out of weakness. Right? It's something gone awry. It's something sickly. Right? It's a defensive reaction of the weak. So our beloved ego, arising from the rotten weeds of lust and fear and anger, has no more continuity than a fever sweat. He's not kidding. It's a beautiful sort of metaphoric moment. But the metaphor here is so powerful because it's not a metaphor. He actually argues that the ego, the concept of the ego, the clinging to the ego, is a sickness. It's not like a sickness. It is a sickness. Right? And it will give way the exact same way a fever sweat will. There is no ego, only a shifting process unreal as the cities of the odor eaters that dissolve in rain. A moment's introspection will demonstrate that we are not the same as we were a year ago, a week ago. This opens many doors. Oh, it's a beautiful moment, right? He asks you then first, he's like, come on, this is obvious. Just think about it for 1 minute. Weren't you different? Yesterday? Were you different a week ago? Were you different a year ago? Doesn't it seem obvious? This opens many doors. It's beautiful. Rather than shutting things down, it opens things up. This opens many doors. Your spirit could reside in a number of bodies, not as some hideous parasite draining the host, but as a helpful little visitor. Roger the lodger. Doesn't take up much room. Show you a trick or two. Never overstay my welcome. Okay? And it talks about the way we inhabit each other. Right? I mean, I was... Before I finally get canned from Berkeley, I'm trying to download all my lectures just so I have a record that I once said something, besides a tagline for somebody. And so I was listening briefly to a lecture on Lauren Green's Poetical Dictionary, and I was cracking up, and I was like, that's hilarious. But it didn't feel like it was me at all. It just felt like Lauren. So I had to write Lauren and thank him for his lecture. Right? It was this beautiful possession, right, of his speech, of his book in my lecture. And then, you know, it's funny when I've taught students sometimes for years, right? I've had students up to 5-6 times in different seminars, of different classes. And it's amazing looking at their writing transform. And I can see my voice enter, how I write enter, and then begin to disappear. Hopefully when they realize I'm full of shit, right? Like, it's a beautiful process, right? But it's this kind of habitation. When I listen to my lectures, you know what I hear? I hear my brother. It's unreal. Unreal. We talk identically. I hear it, I'm like, that I can't be me. That must be my brother. And I purposely tried to sometimes shift my voice. purposefully this semester because I'm like, it's freaking me out. It's identical. If you wouldn't know it wasn't him. We inhabit each other all the time. I know that when I'm around my brother, we get more and more like that. We start talking exactly like each other. We start doing the same hand gestures. And in fact, that happens to me with all my friends. Right? You go with certain friends, you take on each other, you become like a little organism, right? And you go back and forth with each other, and you get a certain speed, and you speak each other's language, and you play off each other. So you're no longer really an individual. You actually become a kind of organism with your friend. Okay? And it's always why I've shied away from bigger groups of people, because it's very hard for that organism to emerge in a bigger group. Okay? One-on-one, you can really get some organisming, as it were. Right? Does that make some sense? That's all he's asking. He's just think about it. Think about it for a second. Right? And I love this. Some of the astronauts were peculiar people, which is such a great non sequitur. Grissom, who was killed in the capsule fire, always ate two meals. It's just random. And Randolph Scott is described as being notably well-developed and heavily muscled. And here's a nice little visitor just for you. Blah, blah, blah. This happens all the time. You think of someone, and you can hear his voice in your throat, feel his face in yours, and his eyes looking at you. You will notice this happens more with some people than with others. And some are more there in voice. I have but to think of Felicity Mason, an English friend, and her clear-clipped upper-class British accent fairly ring through the room. And Gregory Corso has a strong, absent voice. Let's face it. You are other people, and other people are you. Such a great line, right? Let's face it. That's just a beautiful moment of persuasion, right? Shifting the entire terms of the exchange. Like, come on, man. Come on. Just, you know what I'm talking about here. It's so beautiful. It's not really... He's going through all these mad scenes. He's, come on, let's face it. And then he has this nice moment. Take 50 photos of the same person over an hour. Some of them will look so unlike the subject as to be unrecognizable. And some of them will look like some other person. Why, he looks just like Khrushchev with one gold tooth peeking out. Right? And so he makes this beautiful appeal to our lived experience. But this appeal to our experience is precisely this appeal to our own multiplicity. And now you think back on his own essay. And this essay that itself is punctuated and littered with so many different voices. Right? He's saying this is what we are. This is the new terms. I mean, you read this through Roland Barthes, you kind of see this beautiful space of literature and of writing that gets to be carved out, that rather than the death of the author being a negative move, it becomes this great birth. Right? This great proliferation of voices now. It opens many doors. Right? So I love, you can see immediately he shifted the terms here towards this kind of affirmative thinking of immortality, right? And which is premised on a fundamental rethinking of selfhood. Don't find it in the body. Don't find it in the ego. Find it disseminated constantly, right? Like, live, surf all these voices that come through you. Right? I mean, I'm trying to channel Burroughs, but I think as I'm talking up here, how many voices I have to, I'm trying to speak to you. Nietzsche, Burroughs, you know, Phaedrus, Lord Green, right? Me, my brother, Vincent, John, all of you, right? It becomes this kind of organism. What am I? What voice is mine? Let's face it, right? Let's face it. You are other people, and other people are you.
This is especially funny that he says, let's face it there.
Yeah.
When he's mm-hmm. So him and his reader face it together.
Absolutely. Right? And then the face itself, right, is this physical thing.
Yeah.
Right? But it's this kind of animation. Right? And that's what he's going to begin to turn. So the body is animated. It's just this thing that gets animated by all these forces, right? He's very interested in these invisible forces. At times it will sound kind of Christian, right? That the body is a vehicle for the spirit, which he believes. But the spirits for him are certainly not Christian. They are multiple. Right? They're infinitely complex, and they're, he talks a lot about possessions and magic and other forces that come through you. You ever just wake up in a shitty mood? You can't even describe, just feeling a bad mood in a certain place, right? A place will kind of possess you. Right? There just are other things that assemble in this, that are assembled in this invisible world that permeate the visible world. Right? And he's interested constantly in these intersections. Him, the illusion of a separate, inviolable identity limits your perceptions and confines you in time. You will live in other people, and other people live in you. Visiting, we call it. And, of course, it's ever so much easier with one's clonies, which is, again, hilarious. So, you know, it's like the Roland Barthes, that when you stick to this authorship and it's mine and this, you see the tie with capitalism and possession, individuality, authorship, you see these sort of truth, all these claims that attempt to close you off from the world and be certain and fixed are limiting. You want to explode your limit and introduce the infinite limit into play. Right? And so he's like, you know, it's not that all limits go away, it's that your limits now are multiple. Right? You don't want to limit yourself just in this quantitative thing. You want to enter this qualitative space. You live in other people, and other people live in you. Visiting, we call it. That move to we is so fantastic. Because you got to ask, who's we? Visiting, we call it. And of course, it's ever so much easier with one's clonies. Right? This is, again, such a hilarious move he makes. Because it's, I like that it's easier with your clonies. What's a clony? Right? It's like a whole explosion of cloning has happened. This whole other world has happened. And now he's already considered that and speaking about it quite familiarly. So now it's just your clonies.
There should
be a pun on clonies. Ah, good. Absolutely. Absolutely. And he loves the pun. When I first heard about cloning, I thought, what a fruitful concept, which is so great. Because that's all he wants, right? Is the fruitful, the multiple, right? Giving birth to life, the affirmative, right? Why one could be in 100 different places at once and experience everything the other clones did. I'm amazed at the outcry against this good thing, not only from the men of the cloth, but from scientists, the very scientists whose patient research has brought cloning within our grasp. The very thought of a clone disturbs these learned gentlemen. Like cattle on the verge of a stampede, they paw the ground, mooing apprehensively. Right? His deployment of metaphor is always so biting and beautiful. Selfless is an essential fact of life. The thought of human non-selfness is terrifying. Terrifying to whom? Speak for yourself, you timorous old beastie cowering in your eternal laboratory. Right? It's so great. He's constantly throwing these positions. What's at stake in a we? Right? You know, when he's talking about the fact that literary outlaw is the wrong title for his biography, he says, don't ask me what side I'm on. I'm not on your side or not on your side. I might be with you, but I ain't on your side. Right? I might want to go with you, but we ain't one thing, right? So this, who's this we? Who's this we? Terrifying to whom? Right? It's such a great move. He puts the rhetorical claims of any fact, any claim to knowledge right at stake there. That anything you think is certain, for what audience? For who are you talking about here? Right? It's what I always say in your papers when people write, the reader might be confused reading Roland Barthes' claim, The Death of the Author. And I'm always like, what reader are you talking about? You're talking about me? I'm not confused. I have no problem with this. You might be. Don't include me in you. Right? Okay. Is this fun? Is this good? You enjoy reading this?
Yeah.
That's a nice change, right? Have you ever read something like this? It's pretty good, huh? This is it. There's nothing else you need to read except more Burroughs. All right. Should we read more of this over the weekend? We'll just do it on Tuesday? All right. Be free.